This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, May 13th, 2023. And we are on the eve of Mother's Day. And appropriately, we're going to be talking a lot about women's health today. My first guest who will be on at in the next segment will be Dr. Kristen Zarfos. Dr. Zarfos has been a frequent guest on our program before. She is, well, I guess now the former director of St. Francis and Trinity Health's Comprehensive Women's Health Center. She actually retired 11 days ago and has agreed to come on the program to really talk to us about the new guidelines regarding mammogram, which just changed from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Regular listeners to our show know that we've been very critical of the Preventive Services Task Force, and we will go over why we've been critical and how they have in some way rectified what we felt was an error in terms of women getting mammograms at an appropriate age and appropriate frequency. So she'll be on with us. And then at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have Dr. Lenore Williams on. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut. We want to talk about maternal health. The United States is one of only 8 countries in the world where our maternal death rate, that is, death to a mother within 42 days of giving childbirth. So our maternal death rate is one of only 8 countries in the world that is rising. It is the only one, the only industrialized nation where our death rate is rising among women giving birth. So we want to talk to her about that, as to why is this number going up and what are we going to do about it, and learn a little bit more about maternal health. It's not a topic we've ever discussed on our program before, so I really look forward to our chat with her. The COVID-19 positivity here in Connecticut still cruises around 3%, and it seems like it's stabilized. The pandemic has now been declared over. That doesn't mean COVID has gone away. It just means that the international, the worldwide aspect of its spreading has cut down, but it is still down there. And with that, we also have a new vaccine available. I got mine last week, the booster. So for people over the age of 65, folks who have immunodeficiency or an immunocompromised or any complicating features such as diabetes, hypertension, obesity, there's a booster available. We chatted with Dr. David Banik last week, and it was a great conversation about the availability and the need for people to get boosted in order to protect themselves. Here's something I've started to follow, and I think everybody's followed it, and that is the number of mass shootings. And I think it's something we're going to follow on the program now. So far this year, we've had 202 mass shootings in the United States. That's more mass shootings than there have been days in the United States. Now, a mass shooting is defined as an incident where 4 or more victims are either shot or killed. So it doesn't count if the perpetrator is shot or killed. So where 4 or more victims are shot or killed, we've had 202 of these incidents. And that number, so just looking at it, in 2022, the number was 647. In 2021, the number was 690. So it went down a little bit last year, but At this time last year, we only had 183 mass shootings, and we're already up to 202. So it seems like every time we turn the TV on or open a newspaper or go on the internet, there's another mass shooting. And often, more often than not, it's due to the use of an assault rifle, an AR-15 or something similar. This is a weapon. This is a military weapon. It's not a weapon you use for self-defense. And, you know, I'm also tired of people talking about the mental health problem. This is not a gun problem. It's a mental health problem. Since when do we have a bigger mental health problem in the United States than anywhere else in the world? Right? I mean, that just defies any logic. But what we do have, and we know, are more guns than anywhere in the world. So I think that it's really disingenuous of politicians, and we know that they're pandering to NRA, money available, things such as that, okay? But the point is, we don't have a worse mental health crisis than anywhere else in the world. So why do we have more mass shootings? And why do we need more guns? So we're going to be drilling down on that. You're going to be hearing a lot about that. I may sound like a broken record, but it's important because I, like most of you, sit around and worry about this, right? When is it my turn? When am I going to be the victim? When are my grandchildren going to be a victim or my children? And it's not that we've been totally immune here. Let's not forget Sandy Hook 2012, right? We were out in front of school children being murdered. So here in Connecticut, we don't live in some kind of bubble. So it's going to happen. But what are we going to do? What are we doing to stop this? That's what I want to know. It's also funny that the state like Texas, right? Texas says, oh, it's a mental health problem. Then why did they cut mental health care by $211 million last year in their budget? You would think that you would fund more mental health support if that's the issue, if that's why your citizens are dying. So it's really an important topic that we're going to keep an eye on. This day in medicine, and apropos to our Mother's Day theme, May 13th, 1883, Dr. George Papanikolaou was born. He was a Greek-American physician who developed the pap smear in 1933. The pap smear, as many women will know, is where cells are taken from the cervix, scraped from the cervix, and they look for cancer. It's a cancer screening test that's administered women between the ages of 21 and 65, usually get it every 3 years. And it is an accurate predictor of cancer of the cervix, so that women will know if they need to have surgery or some other treatment for that before it spreads. A lot of risk factors, but smoking is a big risk factor for it. And interestingly, with diminished smoking, the incidence has come down. We've seen the most dramatic drop, though, with the use of the human papillomavirus vaccine. Now, that vaccine is administered to teenagers, and it has shown a 50% drop in cervical cancer and other cancers that are triggered by the HPV virus. Some of them oral cancers, some rectal cancers, but most likely, more commonly, cancer of the cervix. So with that, again, people are always saying, when are they going to find a cure for cancer? Well, guess what? We've got a pretty good weapon here in terms of preventing cancer by using a vaccine and really protecting our children. So I urge parents out there, grandparents, to really look into making sure that their teenage children are getting the vaccine to avoid cancer of the cervix. And we remember Dr. Papanikolaou and his really great discovery in 1933. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Kristen Zarfos, and we're going to be talking about the new criteria for mammograms, and even we're going to talk about how you pay for it. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packing,
we're back,
mama.
On Healthy Rounds.
Lay that
I'm your host,
pistol
Dr.
down.
Anthony Alessi. If you have questions for us live on the air, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. Happy to take your questions. And our first guest is Dr. Kristen Zarfos. As I mentioned, she's now the former director of the Trinity Health Comprehensive Women's Health Center, but she remains a fierce advocate for women here in the state of Connecticut. And as we speak, she is at the Connecticut Breast Health Initiative run in New Britain. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me on. It's always great to work with you.
Thank you for taking time from the run today, and hopefully you had a great turnout.
We did. We had, and the weather was with us, and it's about the same issue we want to talk about, empowering women to take care of themselves.
Let's get right to it then. Finally, great. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has shown us some sense in terms of getting on board with an appropriate recommendation regarding mammography. How appropriate is this?
Well, as you and I know, we always look at the glass as full as possible. So I embrace and applaud them for starting mammograms at age 40 rather than 50, which was their previous recommendations in 2016. I mean, and it's taken them a while to come up with new recommendations. However, the recommendations are for mammograms every other year rather than every year. And there has been data around for a long, long time from around the world and looking at the United States that mammograms every year are what's key to impacting the death rate from breast cancer. In other words, we've got to find it early. The data since the 90s with mammograms annually showed 40% decrease in mortality rates. So I'm just puzzled why now we would abandon annual mammograms and go to every other year.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, is this, first of all, I always think, and maybe I'm a skeptic here, but I think these guidelines are driven by insurance companies trying to save money. Am I right? I mean, is that why they're going to every other year?
I don't know, and I don't want to be cynical or unfair without having the facts, but all I know, as you and I as providers, this is harmful to women. And we, if you and I and other providers don't say, come on, let's use common sense here. We have data since 1990, as I said, that shows annual mammograms save lives. Why would we abandon it? So I think your job and my job is to heighten awareness to women for them to be empowered and proactive in saying, look, you know, all these guidelines are confusing. I want a mammogram every year. And I think it's important because 70% of women with breast cancer have no family history of breast cancer. And I think you've done a great job unveiling that myth that, oh, I'm not going to get breast cancer unless somebody in my family has. So we have to, which was what you do every week, empower women with facts.
Well, I thank you, and we try to do that here. But I'm still concerned. You know, I saw another patient this week for an unrelated problem, but again, in her 30s with metastatic stage 4 breast cancer. I know of at least three people personally under the age of 40 with metastatic breast cancer. You know, what are we supposed to do about that in terms of those women?
Well, you know, certainly what you're speaking about, and I don't know the ethnicities of the women that you saw, but 33% of Black women develop breast cancer under the age of 50, and they're at a higher risk. And sadly, there's a lack of education, again, which is your mission, to reverse that among providers. That's doctors, primary care, gynecologists, nurse practitioners, PAs, and among the population. And when the population here's these confusing messages, they just shut down and then abandon everything. So I think we have to educate everybody. We have to also encourage women to know their breasts. And years ago, the concept of self-exam monthly was abandoned based on one study out of China in 2022, even though the authors of that study said women should still do self-exam. But we've abandoned encouraging women to know their bodies and take care of them with self-exam, being speaking out to their physicians. And we need to educate people that breast cancer can happen just like with those women you've addressed at a younger age. How frequently I have heard advocates speak, patients come to me, my doctor says I'm too young to have breast cancer. We need to erase that concept, unveil that myth, and educate people to know that it can happen. I've seen women as young as 28, 23 with breast cancer.
So what about the upper limit, age 74? Okay, so that's where the new guidelines are. Is that appropriate?
No, absolutely not. And the data has been very clear for decades. The highest incidence of breast cancer is women in their 70s and 80s. And so you're right. They say stop at 74. But you know what? You and I know there are so many women out there, 70s and 80s and 90s, that are very vital and have full lives. Now, the American Society of Breast Surgeons and ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncologists, say instead of 74, let's look at a woman's potential longevity. I mean, right. Doctors don't play God, but potential longevity, and continue mammograms as long as we can theorize, or based on their health, that they're going to live another 10 years. I think we have to do that. We can't just say to older women, you don't matter, because a misconception is that older women will have, slow-growing tumors. 20% of women who are in their 70s, 80s, or 90s will have aggressive cancers. And if only we can find them early, we can save them an impact on their quality of life and their dignity by having them diagnosed with delayed breast cancers because they didn't have mammograms.
Well, let's move on, because I want to get to the topic of dense breasts. Okay, this keeps coming up, and something a little bit more about the technology of trying to find cancer. Is a routine mammogram sufficient in evaluating breast cancer in a woman with the so-called dense breasts?
Absolutely not. So we have strong data, and I just have to look, and I'm actually looking at the task force statement that said there, quote, was not enough evidence to assess the risk of women with dense breasts. There's been data that's well respected. For example, Gene Weigert, who's a radiologist in Connecticut, presented at the San Antonio Breast Conference. Now, this is a conference every December where it's an international conference. And let me tell you, they don't allow you to present data. That was 10 years ago. She presented concrete data that a significant number of women with breast cancer who have dense breast tissue, the cancers will be missed unless you do a screening ultrasound. And you and I are proud to be in Connecticut. We have a strong Connecticut General Assembly. And in 2009, they passed legislation that said that insurance should cover screening ultrasounds if a woman has dense breasts. Now, there's another role for MRI, but also I want to stay on ultrasound right now. So the U.S. Preventive Task Force says there's not enough data. There's been data around a long time. So much so that the FDA in September of 2024 will be releasing recommendations that women with dense breast tissue should have further imaging with screening ultrasounds. So now you're the average woman and you receive this letter. So radiographers will have to give a printed report to the patient. You have dense breasts, you should have further studies. And now patients, unless you're in one of the 38 states that has legislation, are going to say, well, will my insurance cover this? Or what does this mean? And you and I know when people are confused, they withdraw. They stop doing mammograms. They stop doing self-exam because there's mistrust in the healthcare system. So these recommendations only create more mistrust.
And if you need to get an advanced study, at least in the state of Connecticut, you do not have to pay any out-of-pocket costs, correct? There's no copays.
That's absolutely right. So Connecticut took the lead in 2009. because of a woman named Nancy Baccaro, who sadly had to express and is no longer with us, and a woman named Jan Kritzman, who was instrumental in Connecticut Public Act 22-90 that says a woman, not only does insurance have to pay for the screening ultrasound, but she need not pay a deductible or a copay, not just for ultrasounds, but MRIs and for diagnostic mammograms or biopsies.
Well, I want to thank you. First of all, I want to congratulate you on retirement, and hopefully you will enjoy your retirement. But I have your number, okay? And I will continue to call on you because of your fierce advocacy for women. Thank you very much, and please enjoy a very healthy and full retirement.
Thank you for this opportunity to do what you do so well, educating your audience.
Thank you, Kristen. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Lenore Williams, and we're going to be chatting about mortality, maternal mortality, here in Connecticut and throughout the United States. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And my next guest is Dr. Lenore Williams, in continuing with our theme of Mother's Day Eve and women's health. I wanted to get Dr. Williams on. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut and spent 25 years in private practice in Eastern Connecticut. And the reason I want to get her on is this: the question of maternal health has been such a big deal, and maternal death rates. It just shocked me that we are among the very few countries where the maternal mortality rate is increasing, and I need to know why, and as I'm sure most of our listeners do. Lenore, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Lissy. Thank you so much for inviting me to discuss this very timely topic, and happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there and others who provide nurturing care for growing children.
Let's get right into it. Well, first of all, some of your background. You've been in private practice before coming into academics. Am I correct?
That's correct. So I did my residency in my medical school at UConn and then practice in a small community hospital in Eastern Connecticut, and did that for about 27 years before returning to UConn.
So can you talk to us a little bit about what is the maternal death rate? How is that calculated? What are we talking about?
So, you know, I think it's important to get our definitions straight. So when we talk about maternal mortality, we're talking about the death of a person while pregnant or within 42 days of termination of a pregnancy. And you would eliminate things like auto accident or a train wreck. You know, that would not be included in that statistic. And this rate is calculated by the number of maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. And to just give you an idea of where we stand, I was looking at data from 2021 here in the U.S. We are at 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births, and that number has gone up since 2019.
So what's driving that number? I've looked at these statistics. I mean, when we get down to basic numbers, in 2020, the number was 861 deaths for the year. Okay, not just over 100,000. But in 2021, it jumped to 1,205 deaths in 2021. Is it purely because of COVID? I mean, what is the driver behind this increase in maternal death?
So I think it's important to recognize and acknowledge that, at least according to the CDC, over 80% of maternal deaths in the United States are preventable. And to your point, in order to prevent these deaths, we need to have a better understanding of why they are occurring. And pregnancy itself is a very complex state, both physically and mentally. And therefore, complications and maternal mortality tend to be very complex, multifactorial, and numerous, and can be determined by certain communities, certain states. They may differ from time to time. But among the leading causes, there are things like cardiac and coronary disease, hemorrhage, blood loss, hypertensive or high blood pressure disorders, sepsis, you know, severe infection, and mental health disorders. And I think all of these things sort of lie at the feet of our inadequate systemic health care system.
First of all, I'm shocked right now because I was shocked at the original number, but the fact that 80% of these are avoidable is... I don't even have a word for it, really. Let's talk about that, because when we look at this, and let's call it what it is, women of color are more susceptible to dying in childbirth. And people think childbirth, right? Everybody loves the analogy. Well, women in China or in Asia, right? They would have a baby and then go back and work in the field. I hate that analogy because it is such a complex issue. But why is it? First of all, let's get right to why are women of color predominantly losing their lives in childbirth?
So women of color, Black women in particular, being pregnant is life-threatening. The number for U.S. mortality was 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births. For Black women, that number is 69.9 deaths for 100,000 live births. And that's 2.6 times the rate for white women. Black women who die as a consequence of pregnancy-related issues typically have significant, there's cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, cardiomyopathies, which are the leading causes for those deaths. And given the fact that there doesn't appear to be a difference when you account for socioeconomic differences, that Black woman with a PhD degree is three times more likely to die as a consequence of being pregnant than a white woman who has a high school degree or less.
And so why is that? Because I mean, typically people who have an education, right, are better informed and should have better access, right, to care. Is it an access question? Because when I look at the states now with the highest maternal mortality rates, I'm looking at Georgia, Louisiana, Indiana, Alabama, Arkansas. Is it an access question?
So, but certainly for women of means, it is not an access question. You know, unfortunately, we have to stare the problem straight in the face. And some of this has to do with the need to evaluate these problems using a health equity lens and a racial lens. For centuries, Black people, Black women in America have sustained all sorts of atrocities, and that certainly takes a toll. And it's the weathering effect, the shortening of telomeres. All of those things, I believe, play a role. In addition to many Black women feel that often during their healthcare encounters that they're not heard, or their concerns are not taken seriously and are dismissed. And I think some of this has to do with implicit bias that is found in some of the healthcare providers.
When we look at, let's look at your field, obstetrics and gynecology. Are young physicians going into OBGYN these days? Because I can't imagine that, to be honest with you. As much as when I was a medical student, it was such a rewarding field. But with the legal climate, the government climate, things like that, are fewer people going into OBGYN?
According to the last match numbers, I don't believe that that is necessarily true. But again, people were making their decisions prior to the reversal of Roe versus Wade. And certainly there is an exodus of obstetrician gynecologists from many of those states who have restrictive practices regarding the full scope of women's reproductive health. And I'm speaking of abortion. Time will tell if fewer medical students are considering obstetrics and gynecology, and if the current climate of this severely draconian restrictive measures regarding comprehensive women's reproductive health care continue to exist. I did want to make one other point. When we're talking about you know, about pregnancy, and often people consider, okay, I delivered my baby, baby's good, I'm good, all is great. It's important to emphasize that 53% of pregnancy-related deaths occur from 7 days after to 1 year postpartum. And the reason that is so significant is that often postpartum care ends at 6 or 8 weeks after the delivery, yet we have some of these catastrophic, deadly things occurring out through a year. Many women do not have insurance coverage that will cover that entire year, and as a consequence, they're not getting care.
So, let's look at it. I mean, we looked at the states where they're having higher incidence of maternal mortality and maternal death. But when we look at the states with the lower numbers, I mean, we're looking at Connecticut, thank goodness, California, Pennsylvania. What are these states doing that these other states are not doing?
So back, I think around 2006, 2007, California did something that was very progressive. They undertook measures to reduce their maternal mortality rate. And what they did was they started to develop this collaborative, which resulted in making up patient safety bundles, which are based on evidence-based practices of best care that could be implemented for common obstetrical issues, things like obstetrical hemorrhage, things like hypertension, things like substance disorder. And California was able to reduce their already low maternal mortality rate by, I think, by about half.
It's by far the lowest in the country.
Yeah.
You're answering the question for me, because I was looking at these numbers and say, why is California at 10.1 and even Connecticut is at 16.7? So,
They made a commitment to reduce their maternal morbidity and mortality. And so many hospitals in, you know, in our area have embraced their toolkits and their safety bundles to further help in reducing maternal morbidity and mortality. The other thing I think it's important to highlight here, and we're talking about things like those conditions that may be as a consequence of the medical aspects of pregnancy, but there are also those things that have to do with maybe perhaps the social aspects of pregnancy. Harvard School of Public Health came out with a study in October that indicated that women in the U.S. who are pregnant, who have recently given birth, are more likely to be murdered than die from obstetric causes. And these homicides are linked to a deadly mix of intimate partner violence and firearms. That knocked me off my chair when I saw that. So, and something like that, you know, I'm not sure whether that would be actually listed in the how that would be listed in the maternal mortality indicators, but you know that I found to be astounding. And so, you know, we certainly have to continue to do appropriate screening for intimate partner violence, do it more thoroughly and more frequently.
Absolutely. These are astounding pieces of information. I wanted to touch on some of the other people that you work with, paraprofessionals, from the standpoint of, can you explain to our listeners the role of midwives, doulas, APRNs? It gets confusing for folks. I mean, they know what a doctor is and what an obstetrician is, but can you explain the role for doulas and midwives and how that impacts the statistics?
So these are folks who all provide valuable contributions to the healthcare team taking care of that pregnant patient and that newly delivered patient and postpartum patient. And you know, depending upon healthcare facility and training, these folks will do different things. Typically, nurse practitioners will have more of a hands-on. They may see patients postpartum or during their office visits, during their prenatal care. Nurse midwives deliver patients as well as caring for them during their prenatal care and their postpartum care. Typically, they're caring for patients who are who do not have known complex medical issues. And then doulas and community health workers, doulas especially, have become more prevalent over the last 5 or 10 years. They provide support, non-medical support, to the mom and to the dad during labor, during postpartum, and they provide that care that it might often be provided by a close friend or a mother. Back in situations where when a woman was pregnant, it was a community event where the community, the village, embraced that woman and took care of her, that woman. And I think we need to start moving back toward that model where we involve more of the community, more doulas, more community healthcare workers. Some patients will get feel that they get better care, more attentive care with nurse midwives. But all of these folks are important contributors to the care of our pregnant patients.
Lenore, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time today and really everything you do for our community. It's a pleasure. It's one of the pleasures of working out in stores, at our health center in stores, is because we have so many different specialists under one roof, and we get to share patients and really learn from each other. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for everything you do, Lenore.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. You have a great day. Happy Mother's Day, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
When Madame Pompadour was on a ballroom floor, said all the gentlemen, obviously.
And, we're going to wrap up today's show. I want to thank my guests, Dr. Kristen Sarfos and Dr. Lenore Williams, for coming on and sharing their work on women's health on this day before Mother's Day. Next week, we're going to be chatting. I wanted to get to this topic, and I mentioned it last week, about loneliness and really the risk and the impact on our health of loneliness. We're also going to be talking about peanut allergy and some of the information that's become available through the article recently published in the New England Journal. With that, I want to thank our studio producer today. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us. Jeff Chandler's in charge of Healthy Rounds for the sales and marketing of Healthy Rounds, as always. And I want to take this time to wish everybody a happy Mother's Day to all the mothers and to all those, as Dr. Williams well put it, who provide care for children and others in their surroundings. It is the key to our society. It is the key to our safety. It is the key to our health. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast. Just download it at Audacy.com. Next up on WTIC is Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.